Hello, welcome live from New York. This is Web Yeshiva. I've always wanted to say that. This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs, coming to you with another installment in our Halachic Man series. As I mentioned, I'm not in my usual haunts in Israel. I am in New York at the moment, broadcasting you live from the home of my mother-in-law. I apologize, I don't have my headset with me. I hope the sound quality is good. Please let me know if there's a problem. But I am muting everyone in the meantime. I'm muting everyone in the meantime because I don't have my headset. If anybody wants to speak up, let me know. As I said, I'm in New York. I'm just posting to the chat schedule of some of the talks that I'm giving. I had a very, very nice weekend in Toronto where I met a lot of Web Yeshiva people, both from the Agnon group and some other folks that came by to some of my talks at Shari Shamayim and at other haunts in Toronto. And if anybody's going to be around tomorrow night, Wednesday night, and Thursday night, I'm speaking at two locations in Manhattan, tomorrow night at Yeshiva University and Thursday night at Lincoln Square Synagogue. And Shabbat I'll be in the suburban New Jersey community. I don't imagine many of you will be passing through there. But if you are, I'd be happy to meet you in the real world. One last scheduling note. Next Tuesday, the class won't meet as I will be on an airplane. And we have not yet figured out how to get the wireless on the airplanes. Although they're probably going to change that soon and we'll even be able to broadcast Rabbi Shiva from in flight. Halachic Man, here we are. Chapter 5 of Part 1. Starting on page 17, is a chapter, it's quite a bridge between the last chapter, which is a discussion of Homo religiosus's view of reality, and what we are about to get into, which is halachic man's view of reality. And this is cognitive man's view of reality. Remember, our characters, our typological characters, the cognitive man, identified as the scientist, homo religiosus, religious man, not to be confused with the ideals that we set forth when we encourage people to be religious. And of course, halachic man who stands above them. Last week we looked at how homo religiosus interprets the real world, the physical world, this world around him. Now we're going to briefly describe cognitive man's view of reality by way of then getting into halachic man's view of reality. I'm going to try to make my way as quickly as possible through this short chapter 5 to see if we can't get into it. I may have mislabeled the title of this class as halachic man's view of reality. I think that's a mistake. This class title should be cognitive man's view of reality. And if we get to it, we will yet start halachic man's view of reality. I'm not going to repeat what I've done in the past two sessions, but if this chart here, different columns, cognitive man, homo religiosus, halachic man, versus the axis of spirit and material, spirit being, material being this world, reality as we know it, and spirit being the realm, the transcendent realm, which is not part of our created existence. This is a handy heuristic to use as we go along. And if you can't answer these questions on any of the topics that we're exploring, to compare how each character relates to or doesn't relate to, ignores, interacts, objects to each of these different boxes. So that means you might do with a review. So last week we looked at Homo religiosus's view of reality, which essentially, again, just by way of reminder, is recognition that we live in a material world, but with a desire to reach the world of the spirit. Cognitive man, who is almost oblivious, is oblivious to anything transcendent and occupying the material world, as we will now explore. Halachic man differs from his worldview from the universal homo religiosus. He resembles in various ways cognitive man. yet he differs in many respects from him as well. In some ways, halachic man is like religious man. In some ways, he is like cognitive man. In many ways, he is neither like this nor like that, and therefore we have to explain these different typologies in order to fully understand who he, halachic man, is. So someone sent in, because I've on occasion made reference to Star Trek, you know, which is one of my great interests in life. So someone, one of you, let me see, someone that does the course by, yeah, he's not online. Someone who does the course by archive, you know, sent in a comparison to the famous topological trio of Kirk and Spock and McCoy. Although there's something, here we go, there's something to be said for it, that of course Spock would be cognitive man and, you know, ruled by logic. And McCoy would be homo religiosus, ruled by emotion. Spock would be cognitive man, ruled by logic. McCoy would be homo religiosus, ruled by emotion. Halachic man would be Kirk. This is not precise. It's not precise, neither. Although I understand what he's doing, and you know, the simple comparison, I understand where it's coming from. And in terms of trying to explore how different typological characters work, it's not bad. And that's part of the power of the character structure in Star Trek, that you have this one character who's wholly emotional and this other who's you know, pure, you know, Spock is pure reason, pure logic, and McCoy, damn it, Jim, I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer. He's dead, Jim. You know, this is a highly emotional, volatile character. These are not exactly parallel, because cognitive man is cognitive not because of logic, but because of, well, other things, as we'll see tonight, although logic is probably part of it. And Spock, of course, was also a scientist. Homo religiosus is not to be identified only with the realm of emotion, although presumably emotion would be part of the characteristics of his life. Indeed, one of the ways in which halachic man differs from homo religiosus has to do with the realm of emotion. Interestingly, when we get to it, I'll point out it's one of the mild critiques that the Rav actually has on halachic. I wouldn't say critiques, but it's one of the manners in which the Rav himself did not fully identify with the halachic man, because Rabbi Soloveitchik felt that there was room for emotion within religious life and experience, in a way that halachic man might not fully accept. And Kirk, to whatever degree, Kirk is a character that's portrayed as being torn between these other two typologies, between the logical Spock and the emotional McCoy. Halachic man is not torn. He is not torn. He possesses different components to his personality, and that is okay, but he's not disabled by it. In addition, there's the other kind of interesting subtext that despite this dichotomy between the two, Spock himself is a dichotomous being. Being half human, he himself is torn between logic and emotion, always ever suppressing the emotion. So Adkan Hilchot Star Trek. But I understand the comparison the person was making is just slightly imprecise. Here we go. So Rav says that halachic man is like cognitive man, he's like homo religiosus as well. Halachic man's approach to reality, and this is the way of introducing cognitive man's approach to reality, is at the outset devoid of any element of transcendence. In that way, he's unlike religious man. Indeed, his entire attitude toward the world stands out by virtue of its originality and uniqueness. All of the frames of reference constructed by the philosophers and psychologists of religion for explaining the varieties of religious experience cannot accommodate halachic man as far as the reaction to empirical reality is concerned. Now, the reference, both here in the English as well as in the Hebrew, of the variety of religious experience is, of course, a reference to William James, the great, you know, perhaps the greatest philosopher of religion in the United States in the 20th century, known for his famous work in the varieties of religious experience. And here, you know, there's a very clear subtext that the Rav, part of the larger agenda, that the study of religion, as it was conducted in Germany and in the United States in the 19th and 20th centuries, is insufficient in being able to understand and categorize and dissect and probe the personality of the halachic man. That it was tooled to analyze the homo religiosus, but the halachic man is a different creature, and you're bringing different tools to understand him. And you're going to be confused. You're going to misunderstand the halachic man if you judge him through all of the prisms that you've formed in order to understand conventional religious men. Halachic man studies reality not because he's motivated by some curiosity in the way that theoretical man is, nor is he driven to explore the world by any fear or being of anxiety or non-being, nor for that matter does halakhic man orient himself to the world in terms of the nebulous feeling of absolute dependence or yearning for the redemption of man or vision of a great ethical ideal. Halakhic man orients himself to reality. So what does he do? What kind of point of view does halakhic man bring to the world when he tries to understand this world that we occupy? Halakhic man orients himself to reality through a priori images of the world, which he bears in the deep recesses of his personality. This concept of the a priori in Hebrew, in halachic parlance, we call lichatchila. A priori, literally in the Latin, means from the outset, prior associations. You bring to it a kind of sense of what reality is, and then you look at reality. Lahavdil, imagine a blueprint. A blueprint is an a priori image of a building. It's a description of reality. It's a plan for reality. It's literally the building instructions for reality. And you look at the blueprint, and then you construct the house. Or if the house is already constructed, you look at the blueprint, and then you look at the house. And you see how the reality corresponds with the ideal. And remember our discussion last week of the Platonic ideal. An a priori understanding might be you're going on a journey, and you look at the map. Nowadays, it's much easier, of course, because we all have GPSs on our phone, and they can map out from point to point where everything is, and it can even predict where the traffic is or where the accident is or things like that. But the map is not reality. The map is an a priori. That's not such a good example because the map is drawn after reality is constructed. The blueprint is drawn before the building is constructed. In other words, but we build roads and streets, and then we can map them to show how the reality. But in terms of imagine a place you've never been to, and you want to know how to get there. So you look at the map. The map is an a priori guide to what your journey is going to be. And then you get in your car and you go. Imagine the old style conventional map where you looked at the map, you kept it in the car in the glove compartment, and you go along. And reality and the plan don't necessarily meet up. They don't necessarily meet up because the route that you're thinking of taking is going to be blocked by construction and you have to take a detour. They're not necessarily going to meet up because you take a look at the map and you assume it's going to take you 20 minutes to get where you're going, and there was a traffic accident, and it takes you longer. But there's a certain ideal journey that you map out, and not ideal meaning like the way you would like it to go, but the kind of abstract ideal as you imagine it should go. And then reality is always somehow a bit more messy. So halachic man orients himself to the reality through a priori images of the world, which he bears in the deep recesses of his personality. Interestingly, the Rav does not the Rav does not make mention of what the source for these a priori images in the recesses of halachic man's personality is. Where does he get these notions? It's presumably not something that we're born with. We're not born with a sense of what reality is. I mean, imagine someone born in a basement someplace who never goes out to experience the world. Imagine, if you will, Plato's metaphor of the cave, of these slaves who are strapped in a cave and they're chained up in a way so that the sun shines from the opening of the cave behind them onto the wall. They see everything just through these kinds of shadows, but they don't have any idea of what the source of the light coming from the outside is. They've never experienced it or they've forgotten it. And when they would be freed from captivity, they would realize that their entire understanding of what reality is, which they only know from this kind of shadow play, these shadow-like, like my kids do, where they make the shadow puppets on the wall. You can take your hand and make it look like a duck. They only know of reality through the shadowy projection onto the wall of the cave. But were they to leave the cave and go out into the world, they would understand that what they had seen is only a projection of reality. It's a shadow of reality. It's an echo of reality, but it is not the real thing itself. So what is the source for halachic man's a priori images? The Rav does not mention here. We will have to wait to see from where those might be formed. But I remind you of the very notion as depicted in the Zohar, of course, of Histakla Kutshabrichu Varaisa Uvara Alma, that God looked into the Torah and created the world. The idea of a kind of primordial Torah, that the world itself, the created world, is a reflection of some kind of Torah ideal. And that puts forth the notion of the Torah itself as the blueprint for creation. I believe there are even books. I believe Arya Kaplan may have such a book. Maybe I'm mistaken. That notion of the Torah, not necessarily the Chumash. When we say the Torah that God looked into, we may be speaking Torah in the abstract or in the metaphor, not necessarily, but perhaps even in the Chumash. Perhaps the Chumash, the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, the Bible as we have it itself, is the blueprint of creation. Perhaps that's another example of what I mentioned of the use of the term halakha. We also do the same thing. So sometimes halakha is, as I've said, with a lowercase h, meaning dinim, laws. What is the halakha of when Tanit Esther is observed in the case of the 13th of Adar falling on a Shabbat, as it happens this year? When do we fast? That's a halakha. And then there's halakha with a capital H, as a kind of synonym for the entirety of the Jewish worldview as it is derived from the body of Torah teaching, principally the Gemara, but not only. So too with Torah. Sometimes Torah is a reference to that book that we keep in the Holy Scroll in the Aron in Shul. And sometimes Torah is a synonym for, or Raita in its Aramaic expression, is a synonym for the system as a whole. So when we say God looked at the Torah and created the world, what is the definition of Torah? We may, if we so desire, call this what halachic man does. We may, if we so desire, call this a cognitive normative approach. But it is not to be identified with the cognitive and ethical orientation of which the philosophers of the cognitive man par excellence speak. We know that cognitive man is a dual approach to reality. One, an empirical a posteriori approach. A posteriori is the opposite of a priori. What we say in halach language, bidi avad, bidi eved, ex post facto, after the fact. We measure something, and then we know what it is. After experience, we then understand something about reality. That's a posteriori. From empiricism, right? From experience. Newton sees the apple fall, and from the empirical observation, he makes a declaration about some of the rules that govern creation. Two, an a priori approach. From the outset, the hypothesis, the belief that we bring beforehand. It need not be emphasized that the entire dispute between rationalists and empiricists centers around this problem. Even within the cognitive school, even within the scientific school, there are different approaches, there are different schools of thought. The rationalist approach, which would correspond with the a priori school, that through reason we can speculate about creation, and the empiricist approach, that through experience, through observation and testing, through this what we often call the scientific method, we observe reality, we draw hypotheses, those are tested and either proven or rejected, that would be the a posteriori approach. But these two approaches of cognitive math, before the fact and after the fact, are the dual relationships by which he approaches reality. In truth, this disagreement within the cognitive tradition symbolizes two different directions in man's relationship to reality. When cognitive man scrutinizes God's world and seeks through critical probing, through experimentation, to determine its nature, I am not concerned here with the nature of the cause of the precipitous cognition, he arrives at two differing decisions. So when cognitive man looks at the world and tries to hypothesize and tries to understand and tries to determine the governing laws, there are two different decisions. Number one, to plunge into the very midst of reality and to contemplate its appearance in order to understand its essence and structure, cognitive man, in this instance, approaches the world without preconceived programs, without any elaborate preparations. He gropes in the darkness. He's astonished and amazed by the plethora of phenomena and by the chaos and void which prevail in the realm of reality, until he stumbles across a repetition of events in a certain order, which he has dimly sensed to begin with, as a result of which he can construct rules and establish laws that can serve as a beacon illuminating the road on which he travels through the cosmos. After experimentation, we have laws, we know how gravity works, and then we can travel through the cosmos, and we can assume that gravity works the same way on Earth as it does every place else in the universe. That doesn't mean that the force of gravity is equal on Earth to what it is on Mars or to what it is at the lip of a black hole. But gravity works the same way. It's just going to alter based upon the pull of the body in question. But the formulas would all be the same. Number two, in order to overcome the mystery in existence, he constructs an ideal, ordered, and fixed world. We look at the world, it's chaos, it's confusion, it's questions. Ancient man looked out at the cosmos and had to create a whole myth. Think of Greek mythology, which is largely invented in order to make sense of how the world works. Much of Avodah Zarah, much of idolatry, emanates from an attempt to understand how the world works, how natural phenomena work, in the absence of any kind of scientific explanation. The world is a mystery. if you live in a pre-scientific age, thunder and lightning are confounding in addition to being frightening. So you imagine the gods warring in the heavens, having a fight, having an argument, throwing lightning bolts at each other. It's an a posteriori, it's a bidi evid explanation to try to make sense of a phenomena that presents itself. In order to overcome the mystery in existence, he constructs an ideal order in a fixed world. And then you superimpose those ideas for what would cause rain, what would cause flood, what would cause the seasons to come and go, why the moon waxes and wanes. And then as your knowledge grows, you can improve the constructions, the ideal ordered and fixed constructions that you superimpose on the world in order to understand it, in order to make it clear and lucid. Let me skip ahead a drop. He has no wish to passively cognize reality as it is in itself. Right? This is not an attempt to be a nature lover. This is not an attempt to worship nature. As a matter of fact, cognitive man is not interested in nature as nature. He's interested in the natural world as a mystery that presents itself. Rather, first he creates the ideal a priori image, the ideal structure, and then he compares it with the real world. You reverse engineer. You look at the world, and then you try to draw the blueprint. In other words, to try to take it apart to understand what it is that stands behind this. That's sometimes hard to do. It's sometimes hard to do that without actually dismantling the house. So you try to reverse engineer creation to understand the laws that govern it. His approach to reality consists solely in establishing the correspondence and effect between his ideal a priori creation and the concrete reality. More even than the theoretician with his a priori system gets involved in technological utilitarian aspects of science, there too his sole aim is to reveal a parallelism that prevails between the ideal series and the concrete series. And having achieved his aim, he has fulfilled his task, for he is concerned not with the concrete qualitative phenomena themselves, but only with the relationships that prevail between them and the a priori ideal constructs. But the theoretician, the theoretical physicist, is not concerned with how things play out in reality. And it's not just in sciences, by the way. In all fields, usually there are theoreticians, and then there are people that actually do the work. And often there's a tension that exists between. In medicine, you have this all the time. There are people that go into medicine with no interest in treating patients, in treating disease, in working as clinicians or therapists. They're laboratory scientists. And they choose that path either because they have no interest in treating actual human beings, they don't have the characteristics that are necessary for any kind of mode of bedside matter. They're just working in the laboratory. And sometimes they come up with solutions that are going to not work because they're unaware of the actual implementation limitations of what happens. In all fields you have this. When we created the Web Yeshiva. So the Web Yeshiva is a combination of people on the tech side and people on the education side. And these are two people trying to work together who don't always speak the same language. And those computer guys, they have a sense of how things work. But in order for this to spill out the way we wanted it to, it had to be something where the technology would serve the educational aim and not the other way around. You know how those computer guys are, you know, you tell them, I don't know if Ezra's listening in. Ezra does our tech support. You know, it's a great name for a guy who does tech support. You know, you have a problem with your computer, the first thing they always tell you is, well, turn it off and turn it back on. That's always the solution to everything. Or you say, well, my computer won't do this. Well, don't do that. You know, the doctor, it hurts when I go like this. Don't go like that. It's the first call of solution. There's a joke, a story from the realm of business as well. A guy in the business world goes back to his business school with his MBA. And he goes and he meets his old professor. And he tells his professor about a certain business idea, a business model that he's thinking of. And the professor tells him 100 reasons why it's a terrible idea, why there'll be no investors, why he'll never see a profit, why he'll sink the wealth of nations in trying to do so, and how it'll never get off the ground. And the student says to him, I'm sorry, professor, you misunderstand me. This isn't a plan. This is what I've already done. And the company's been taken public. And we're very successful. And every quarter we have a big profit margin. And stocks are high. So the professor says to him, listen, Sonny, don't confuse me with the facts. It may be perfect in practice, but it'll never work in theory. That's the exact opposite of that. The theoretician sees things from a certain way, and he's sometimes oblivious to reality because reality and theory don't always match up. The blueprint and the building don't always match up, not just because the contractor shaved some things off the specs on the construction. But even if everything is built exactly, the nature of reality is that it doesn't always conform to the ideal. So the theoretician is not concerned with the concrete. He's not even concerned with the execution. I have a friend who's a musician who told me that he knows a composer who never goes to hear the concert played. The composer is also a form of theoretician. He composes music on paper, like the architect builds a building, quote unquote, on paper. Right? But he never actually wants to hear it played, because in his head, you know, in the Platonic ideal of what the piece of music is in his head, it always sounds better than what's going to happen once the musicians get their hands on it. I'm told that sometimes writers feel the same way about what the stage producers or the movie makers do with their written word. Similar idea. This latter approach is that of mathematics and mathematical natural sciences. The crowning achievements of civilization. It's both a priori and ideal, that is to no means to construct an ideal lawful unified system whose necessity flows from its very nature, a system that does not require, as far as its validity and truth are concerned, precise parallelism with the correlative realm of concrete qualitative phenomena. On the contrary, all that we have is an approximate accord. I'm sorry, I've lost my place. The concrete empirical triangle is not exactly identical with the ideal triangle. These are examples, actually, that we gave last week. I forgot, I think it was Peter. Is Peter online? Where's Peter? He never misses. Peter, if you're listening to the archives, where are you? I think Peter made reference to, in the realm of geometry, that a line between two points doesn't actually exist. I mean, it doesn't exist in space. It has no breadth to it. But when we depict it, we obviously have to depict it with breadth. The same thing here in the case with the triangle. The same holds true for all other mathematical constructs. There exists an ideal world and a concrete one. And between the two, only an approximate parallelism prevails. And again, this harkens back to what we spoke about last week about the Platonic ideal. in truth, not only from a theoretical ideal perspective does mathematics pay no attention to concrete correlatives, but even from a utilitarian standpoint, the mathematical approach has no desire to apprehend the concrete real, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is the cognitive man's approach to the world. That is the cognitive man's approach to the world. It's the world of looking at a blueprint and then approaching reality, or approaching reality and then trying to reverse engineer the plan to understand the laws that govern the natural phenomena at work. That movement between the two. In some ways, halakhic man's approach is more similar to cognitive man's approach than it is to religious man's approach. And we will get into, I'm going to use my visit to New York to take the opportunity to cut short what we're doing today, but we'll see as we move into the important chapter 6, which contains perhaps one of the most evocative, well-known passages in Halakhic Man. Halakhic Man's vision of reality. Halakhic Man goes out into nature and he sees a spring. He sees a sunset. What does he see? When he's wearing the X-ray glasses of the halakha, what do you see when you see the sunset or you see the pool of water? Well, unlike cognitive man, who sees things through the perspective of this is my example of the architect. Right? You can even imagine this being depicted in film. Right? You know, a film about an architect. Some great tormented architect. He goes around it in the film. You'd see him walking through Manhattan, of course, looking at the skyscrapers, looking at the buildings, and when we, the viewer of the film, would see what he sees through his point of view, you would see the blueprints, you know, superimposed over the buildings. And you would see how the reality and the blueprint don't match up. And then when he looks at the building, he wants to reverse engineer it back to the level of the ideal blueprint. Because on the blueprint, it's always going to be perfect. The blueprint represents the ideal plan, the plan for perfection in its ideal. The building, by definition, is always somehow going to be compromised in reality. And that's a source of frustration for the cognitive man, the architect. Halakhic man wears a different set of glasses when he goes around looking at the world. Do you remember that there was that film about that woman? I'm sorry, I should have prepared this in advance. Someone will remember that woman who has Asperger's syndrome, you know, but she's like a genius and she's the one that like revolutionized how the slaughterhouses are run. She was an animal behaviorologist and she was able to imagine. So when that, you know, this film, what was it called? Temple Grandin was her name, but what's the name of the movie? Or is that the name of the movie? There's a woman. She's. I think she's still alive. Her name is Temple Grandin. It's a great name, Temple. She has some form of Asperger's syndrome or something like that. But she's some kind of genius about the world of animal behavior, and she has been like the leading figure in how slaughterhouses work, how large industrial farms work, and how they're set up. In order to be, not just to be more humane, but also to be more efficient and more, she's not an animal rights, meshuggah. You know, I think she believes that, you know, we can slaughter animals for meat. She's not like one of those people. But when in the movie, the point I'm getting at is in the movie, you know, she's obviously somebody because of her situation, she sees the world differently than most people do. And the movie is very efficient, very effective in trying to communicate, what the world looks like to her, and how she's then able to see the world through the perspective of the animal going through the feed feed yet. I presume if you Google it, you'll be able to find like a clip on YouTube where you see this. Let me see if I can't find it very quickly. Oh, there, trailer. Yeah, perfect. Thinking in Pictures, it's called. If you Google on YouTube, oh, perfect. And they've been showing pictures of the blueprints. It's exactly the image I was searching for. Here's a link to a clip on YouTube that shows this. So imagine that cognitive man depicted on film. We can easily imagine, use my example of the architect and the building. Well, halakhic man too wears a set of kind of X-ray goggles through which he views the world, and that of course are the goggles of the halakha, which cause him to see reality, to perceive reality with this kind of additional superimposed layer through which he interprets it. And that is the subject of chapter 6, which we will get to, again, not next week, because I'll be traveling, but the week after. But please do try to read ahead. I welcome your feedback and questions, many, all of which I'll say, but many of which have been very, very insightful and helpful to me, even the ones about Star Trek, even if it didn't get it exactly. So we should all dedicate ourselves to learning more Torah, and in the spare time, we should dedicate ourselves to a deeper understanding of Star Trek. And some would argue that there's an overlap. Those of you listening to this archive many years in the future should know that I was trying to be lighthearted at that last statement. Okay, so we'll continue in 2 weeks. And again, if anybody's in New York, I'd be very happy to see you at any of these venues that I'll be appearing. Thanks.